Welcome to Vashon 250. As America observes its 250th birthday, Voice of Vashon and the Vashon Heritage Museum have partnered to create our own recognition of this important milestone. We are looking back at what has happened in America since its beginning and examining how, over time, it has influenced our life on Vashon Island. In this second quarter of 2026, we continue to look at several of the famous high points that ultimately led to the Revolutionary War. I'm John Flora, and I'm joined by my colleague, resident historian, Bruce Holman. Today, we are looking at the First Continental Congress. And just to make things truly American, there were actually multiple Continental Congresses, and we'll discuss that in the later on in this episode and in the weeks ahead. The First Continental Congress in 1774 was created in response to the Boston Tea Party and the Coercive Acts in 1774, called the Intolerable Acts that we discussed earlier, which closed Boston Harbor, restricted colonial self-governance, and forced colonists to house British troops. 56 delegates from 12 of the 13 colonies, note, Georgia did not send delegates because they were still getting help from Britain, met in Philadelphia in September to October 1774. Key figures included George Washington, John Adams, Samuel Adams, and Patrick Henry.
Yeah, it's important to remember that the Congress, this First Continental Congress, was not seeking independence. Its goal was to restore colonial rights within the British Empire. It drafted a Declaration of Rights and Grievances, formally asserting that Parliament had no right to tax the colonies without their consent. This is the no taxation without representation. It also created the Continental Association. And this is important because the Continental Association, we don't hear much about it, but it was a coordinated boycott of British goods that was remarkably effective at uniting the colonies, both economically and politically. Crucially, the delegates agreed to reconvene the next year in May 1775 in what would be the Second Continental Congress if Britain did not address their grievances. I mean, it was kind of an ultimatum. And this agreement alone was significant. It established the precedent of the colonies acting as a unified body. The First Congress demonstrated that the colonies could cooperate beyond local interest. It was the first real step toward a continental identity, moving colonies from thinking of themselves purely as Virginians or Pennsylvanians toward thinking of themselves as Americans.
And then in 1775, a year later, as you noted, the Second Continental Congress, which we'll talk more about on June 2nd, came together. Britain ignored colonial grievances. And by the time delegates reconvened in May 1775, the battles of Lexington and Concord had already been fought. The colonies were at war, whether they wanted to be or not. The Second Congress was forced to act as a de facto national government, despite having no formal legal authority to do so. Its achievements were enormous, given these constraints. It established and funded the Continental Army and appointed George Washington as its commander-in-chief in June 1775, which we'll talk about on May 12th. It issued paper currency to finance the war and negotiated directly with foreign governments. In a last attempt at reconciliation, it sent the Olive Branch Petition in 1775, which we'll talk about on May 26th, to King George III. He refused to even read it and declared the colonies in rebellion. This rejection pushed more moderates toward independence. Most consequentially, on July 4th, 1776, the Congress adopted the Declaration of Independence, formally dissolving the colonial relationship with Britain and announcing a new nation to the world. It later drafted and adopted the Articles of Confederation in 1777, America's first constitution, which took effect in 1781.
So the Second Continental Congress essentially governed a nation that didn't yet exist. It made war, it undertook diplomacy, it created laws simultaneously under enormous pressure and held together long enough for the revolution to succeed. The two Congresses, the First and Second Continental Congress, represent a remarkable political evolution in just a few years. From colonial assemblies seeking to redress grievances within the British system to a revolutionary government declaring and winning independence, they established a tradition of representative, deliberative governance that shaped the Constitution and the American political culture ever since.
So, Bruce, as I look at this and think about it, it is a remarkable accomplishment that this even happened. Now, the circumstances being what they were that caused it, that's understandable. But the fact that the people could actually come together and get this done is truly remarkable.
Oh, it's very remarkable. And it's also a remarkable time in sort of history. It's a development of the Enlightenment that's taking place in Europe. Concepts of what it means to be an individual and be a person, what rights an individual have, are all sort of in discussion in a way that they never had been before. And what makes it so remarkable is that within this few years period, you have that expressed in the Declaration of Independence with these, you know, sort of a very aspirational statements about all people being equal and life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And at the same time, you have this very practical, how are we going to make it work? And it becomes this kind of political machine, if you will. We're going to develop a machine, a sort of Enlightenment kind of concept of a machine that's changeable but workable and will carry us into the future. So it is a very remarkable turning point in human history.
And you can see where the American way was developed. I mean, it was different. It was something untried for the most part in history.
Yep.
And today we look back at that and go, now I know why we are what we are, for better or for worse.
Yeah, and it goes back to the whole concept of the Americas as a new world. And it really is partly a culmination of that European sense of here is a new world with new possibilities. You know, this Rousseauian, you know, sort of idea of a noble savage, you know, and this sort of new people in a new land can create a whole new government. I mean, it's a very powerful kind of mythology that develops around this.
Yeah. So, Bruce, as always, there are numerous events over the next 250 years of American history that echo these events. What would you consider to be some of the most significant?
Well, we're talking about the Continental Congress here, and so it's that idea of you know, groups gathering together to sort of plan their future or take control of their future. And there have been a number throughout American history, not always as ground-shaking or as monumental as the Continental Congresses, but in 1814-15, you have what's called the Hartford Convention. And it was basically a meeting of Federalist delegates from the New England states who opposed America entering the War of 1812. They discussed a constitutional amendment to limit Southern and Western political power. They even debated whether New England should secede from this new American nation. And what's fascinating is just as they were finishing, the war concluded. And so it made their grievances moot. And yet it effectively destroyed the Federalist Party because they were sort of the disloyalist, if you will, in this first American war. You know, War of 1812 is sort of the first time America as an independent nation goes to war. And they go to war against Great Britain.
And then that was followed up a number of years later by the Nashville Convention in 1850. It was called by the Southern states to discuss their response to the Compromise of 1850, which was really an effort to balance out free states and slave states. As new ones came in, one would be free, one would be slave. And so this convention was brought together, and the growing tension over slavery clearly came to the boiled up. Delegates met twice, debated whether to accept the compromise or pursue a more confrontational course. It was an early signal of the secessional thinking that would culminate in the Civil War.
Yeah, you know, and again, you had something similar to that occurring in 1861, just before the Civil War began. It was called the Washington Peace Conference. And it was kind of a last-ditch effort to prevent the Civil War. You know, delegates from 21 states met in February 1861, just weeks before Lincoln's inauguration and the outbreak of hostilities at Fort Sumter. So, and they proposed constitutional amendments to protect slavery in the southern states. Congress rejected these proposals. Their efforts failed entirely. And of course, within 2 months, we were in the middle of the American Civil War. So there have been these kinds of attempts to sort of create congresses or meetings to find a way to avoid a conflict.
So let's then skip ahead to the Civil War era. The Confederate Constitutional Convention in 1861 convened in Montgomery, Alabama, where delegates from the seceding southern states drafted a Confederate Constitution and established a new government. In structure, it closely mirrored the U.S. Constitutional Convention, which is a testament to how deeply that model had embedded itself in American political culture.
Yeah, and what's fascinating about that sort of Confederate Constitutional Convention is it sort of took all the grievances that the southern states had and sort of tried to encompass them within this new Confederate States Constitution, sort of limited the power of the central government, made state governments more powerful. And that's been a continuing tension in American political life ever since the First Continental Congress. It's sort of how much power do you give to the central government? How much power do you reserve to the states? And how do you find that balance?
And states' rights continue to be an issue today.
Very much so.
Yeah.
Yeah, very much so. And you see that those same kinds of what I would call conventions, meetings to sort of create either new governments or new ways of sort of relating to one another, continuing into the 20th century, not so much on the American political level, but more on the international level. Particularly after the devastation of World War I and the Versailles Treaty, which was a very punitive, end of World War I. But within it was an attempt to create a League of Nations. And, of course, the American Congress was unwilling to go along with Woodrow Wilson's signing of this League of Nations treaty. And so America didn't participate. And, of course, it collapsed. And what we see emerging out of it is World War II. But coming out of the destruction of World War II, you have the Bretton Woods Conference, which most people don't know about. But it's the conference in 1944, as the war is coming to an end, that created the International Monetary Fund, essentially agreeing that the nations of the world are going to have common sort of currency policies and sort of relate to one another in a way that prevents these sort of emergence of global collapses like the Great Depression. And, of course, the International Monetary Fund has been incredibly successful, for the last 70, 80 years. And right now we're seeing it under stress by the current Trump administration. But it's still functioning, and you still have this kind of international monetary policies at work. And it's very, very effective. And then coming out of that, and the end of the war is the Atlantic Charter, which was the initial attempt by the Allies in World War II to look to the post-World War world. And then a meeting in San Francisco in 1945 that adopted the United Nations Charter, going back to the old concept of a League of Nations, but this time trying to create a United Nations, sort of a Congress, if you will, of nations that meet together. And it's had successes and failures, but again, it's an attempt to sort of come together and recognize that we have issues that transcend national borders.
So would the Marshall Plan been related to all this?
Yeah, tangentially, yes. You know, I mean, the United States emerged out of World War II as the sort of only major industrial power, Western industrial power, that was untouched by the relatively untouched by the war. At the end of World War II, 1945-46, the United States was responsible for 80% of the world's gross production.
Wow.
I mean, you know, you think about that. I mean, today I think the United States is in the 35-40% sort of range. I mean, we dominated the world industrially, economically, and of course politically. And what emerges out of that is the Marshall Plan, because George Marshall and Theodore Roosevelt, I mean, Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman recognized that if the United States didn't help Europe rebuild, that we were going to see a World War III with the emerging power of the Soviet Union. And so what you get is a whole set of policies that develop after World War II, along with the Marshall Plan to rebuild Europe, along with a series of alliances, NATO being the primary one, but also CETO, the Southeast Asian Treaty Organization, the ANZUS Treaty, Australia, New Zealand, the United States, all designed essentially in George Kennan's concept is to encircle the Soviet Union, contain the growth of the Soviet Union, allow Europe to reestablish itself as a counter to the emerging Soviet power. And what it created essentially is the Cold War that sort of created this balance, a balance of terror in many people's terms, because both sides had nuclear weapons. And then you have the emergence of China in the late 1940s and early 1950s. And essentially what you had is a 60, almost 70-year period of relative peace in the world. No World War III. And that's really what comes out of that.
Yeah. And that, you think about trying to package all that up, that too was very complicated to make happen, and it's pretty amazing in its own right.
Yeah, John, what ties all these gatherings together that we've been talking about, I think, is a distinctly American political habit that when existing institutions seem inadequate for a particular crisis, Americans have repeatedly returned to the idea of convening a new representative assembly to deliberate and to act. Some of these meetings saved the republic, some failed, some accelerated conflict, but they all reflect that enduring belief, I think, rooted in these First and Second Continental Congresses, the tradition that legitimate power flows from the consent of the governed, assembled together, making decisions and directing the future of the nation.
So that leads me to ask you a question, Professor. Do you think we will have one of these conventions start up again anytime soon?
I think it's very possible. What we have seen, particularly in the last year, year and a half, is essentially that the guardrails that were so very purposefully constructed by the Second Continental Congress in developing the U.S. Constitution, that those guardrails are essentially by consent and by sort of practice. They're not written into hard sort of law or hard sort of constraints within the Constitution. And what we've seen is, I think, tremendous stress on those conventions, if you will, or those practices that are sort of assumed within the structure of the Constitution. This balance of power between the Congress, the executive, and the judiciary, they work great when those branches are independent. When those branches become intertwined in a way that they don't effectively balance one another, what you see is the government becoming unbalanced. And that has happened numerous times in the past in American history, when one political power dominates over another political party. But at the same time, those have been relatively short-lived, and a balance tends to restore itself. And I think where we are right now in the middle of 2026 is we're beginning to see sort of an emergence of people wanting to limit the power of the central federal government, provide more power to the states. And I think it's very possible that there may be some kind of new constitutional convention. I worry a little bit about calling a new constitutional convention and rewriting the constitution, but the idea of how do we strengthen the concepts of balance of power within the Constitution to ensure that the guardrails are stronger than just by practice and by agreement. I think we're going to see some kind of commission or some kind of convention or some kind of legal laws being passed, if you will, over the next 5 to 10 years. That sort of address what we see right now as these sort of imbalances that have been created within the American political system.
Well, the other question will be if the Congress and the three branches of government can get back to working together, right. And that has largely disappeared over a long time now. It's not just the last couple of years.
It's
significant now, but it's happened for longer than we'd like.
Yeah, and it's not that they're not working together. It's they're working together too closely.
Yes,
is the issue.
Yeah,
and it's sort of like these were set up in the eyes of the original founders, and we'll talk about that later in the show when we talk about the constitutional convention and creating the U.S. Constitution. And the development of the Federalist Papers that sort of discuss all of these issues in some detail. And people at the time worried about the same things we're worrying about today. And so it's not that the three branches aren't working together. They're working too closely together, and they're not providing the balance and the checks and balances is the whole fundamental concept of the American Constitution. And when there's no checks, there's no balances.
So let's, as we always do, let's look at Vashon. What are some of Vashon events that echo these national and recent meetings?
Well, I think a number of things. We've talked about it before, but to me, one of the most significant is the creation of a Vashon Ferry District. After World War II, essentially ferry strikes had been sort of outlawed during World War II. I mean, it wasn't against the law, but everybody agreed there were going to be no strikes. Everything was going to be sort of held static during the war to support the war effort. And, of course, the ferry, which were all in private ownership at that time, made tons of money because there were just thousands of people riding the ferries back and forth across the Sound because of the big shipyards in Seattle, the Bremerton shipyard, the munitions plants. I mean, all the things that, Boeing sort of in the industrial area. So it was a time when ferries made money. After the war, all that work sort of went away or sort of declined significantly. And so the ferries started raising prices. And when they did, you started to have, consumer resistance, but you also had resistance from the unions who wanted to have their pay increased because they had no pay increases since the war began in 1941. And so what you have is a series of devastating strikes in 1946, 1947, in which the ferries are shut down for months at a time. If you live on Vashon Island,
that's a problem.
You know,
and we've only experienced it in a minimal way in recent years.
Yeah,
in comparison.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, all these disruptions of having to cancel a ferry because of lack of crew. I mean, those are 1 or 2 day events.
Yeah,
there may be a lot of them, but but ultimately the ferry comes back. But when it doesn't come back for a month. It's a very different situation. So Vashon Islanders just got together and decided, to hell with them, we're going to create our own ferry district. And they had a general meeting, a convention, if you will, and they voted to create a ferry commission. The state had created a law that allowed counties to create ferry districts. Which was reconstituted for the walk-on ferry, King County sort of water taxi. But in 1947, Vashon created King County Ferry District Number 1, which allowed Vashon to run a ferry system. They got a couple ferries from King County that county had used to cross Lake Washington, and of course the Lake Washington Bridge had just opened right before the war. And so they had these decrepit old ferries, and they sort of hammered together a ferry system. The Coast Guard kind of looked the other way to keep these ferries running. But Vashon, and until 1951, ran their own ferry system. And it worked very, very well. Another example, of course, is sort of like, Vashon doesn't have its own government. And so what happens, how do you make decisions as a government if you don't have a government? And what happens on Vashon Island is essentially you have the creation of clubs in the 1920s and 1930s that sort of take on that function. The Camulus Club. In the 1930s, you have the creation of a businessman's club that sort of function as a, Chamber of Commerce, voice for the island. I mean, it's not really well organized. But in 1963, you have what's called the Jigsaw Project, which was the first sort of comprehensive planning effort by the island. And out of it comes a number of things. When the health district comes out of it, a ferry advisory committee comes out of it, a transportation committee. I mean, all kinds of things sort of spin out of that jigsaw plan. But one of the significant ones in terms of governance is the creation of a community assembly, an island assembly, essentially. They essentially wanted to call it a community council, but some people on the island who had opposed that
yes.
went down to Olympia and registered community council as a registered name, so that the Vashon folks had to call themselves the Civic Assembly for about 3 or 4 years, and then finally they were able to call themselves the community council. And the community council that came together in the late 60s functioned through the 70s and 80s into the 90s fairly significantly as a voice for Vashon to the King County Council, to the state of Washington. And it provided a forum for islanders to discuss issues. Of course, that collapsed in 2011, and we'll come back and talk about why that collapsed at a later time. But then in 2020, I think 2020, 2021, it was reconstituted, and right now it's trying to assert itself as a voice of the island, a voice to King County in an island that doesn't have representation.
That's a wrap to this episode. Bruce and I invite you to join us again each week through the end of 2026 for interesting stories about our collective American and Vashon Island history. If you have a question, comment, or suggestions of a topic we might want to cover, please drop an email to vashon250@voiceofvashon.org. Vashon 250 is a production of Voice of Vashon and the Vashon Heritage Museum. Our producer is Truman O'Brien. Vachon 250 is sponsored by NACM Business Credit Services, a 126-year-old association focused on credit education and professional financial services for business credit departments across the nation. For more information, go to nacmbcs.org. We appreciate their support. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.